When an archaeologist digs up an ancient city, they are absolutely thrilled to find something like a merchant's ledger.
Oh, sure, yeah, like a clay tablet or something.
Exactly. A clay tablet that just lists, who bought grain from whom. It's this perfect window into how a whole society operated thousands of years ago.
The literal receipts of history.
Right, the receipts. But I mean, imagine if that clay tablet also had the power to reach across time and actually throw the people who wrote it in jail centuries later,
Wow. Yeah.
like a time capsule that bites back.
That is a really brilliant way to frame it, actually. Because in the digital age, the ruins we leave behind aren't just, historical curiosities destined for a museum.
Right.
They're perfectly preserved, mathematically sealed traps for the very people who built them.
And that is exactly what we are getting into today, because thousands of years from now, archaeologists won't be digging up clay tablets. They'll be digging up the blockchain.
They absolutely will.
We are looking at a really fascinating piece of source material today. It's an article titled Inside Silk Road's Dark Economy: Drugs, Bitcoin, and the Ellingson Case.
A great read.
It really is. And our mission from you on this deep dive is to explore how a darknet marketplace that was shut down like over a decade ago is still right now generating massive international legal battles.
Yeah, it's wild.
And in the process, we're going to completely shatter the myth of digital anonymity.
Because this isn't just some historical true crime story. I mean,
Yeah.
it is a live, ongoing case study.
Right, it's happening right now.
Exactly. It shows us the actual mechanics of how digital criminal ecosystems generate durable, permanent evidence. Evidence that investigators can leverage years or even decades after the original crime.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this story has, well, alleged global drug empires, a multi-million dollar digital paper trail, and a fake hitman plot that sounds like a rejected Hollywood movie script.
It really does sound like a movie.
Totally. But to understand the stakes, we have to look at the architecture of Silk Road itself, which operated between 2011 and 2013. The whole pitch was total invisibility, right?
Right, yeah. The foundational infrastructure relied on two distinct technologies that were sort of working in tandem. First, you had Tor.
Right, the onion router.
Exactly. Tor is a network designed to conceal the physical location of both the users and the servers hosting the marketplace. So theoretically, law enforcement couldn't locate the physical server rack.
And they couldn't see the IP addresses of the users logging in either, right?
Correct. Total physical obfuscation. And second, you combine that with Bitcoin.
Which was still pretty new back then.
Very new. But it allowed for remote peer-to-peer payments without ever touching conventional credit card networks or, traditional banking systems.
So you have untraceable locations meeting supposedly untraceable money. But
Exactly.
they didn't just build like a chaotic secret chat room where people haggled in the dark. The source notes, they built a highly sophisticated e-commerce platform.
Oh, highly sophisticated.
We're talking searchable listings, detailed vendor profiles, customer reviews, dispute resolution boards, and a massive escrow system.
Yeah.
It was basically a dark web Amazon. But looking at this logically, I mean, if you're running a massive illegal enterprise, isn't building a customer service interface with permanent written reviews and escrow receipts the absolute worst possible idea?
It sounds like it, yeah.
You're basically constructing a pristine evidence room for the cops and putting a bow on it.
Well, what's fascinating here is the paradox of trust in a trustless environment. Let's think about how illicit trade works in the physical world.
Okay.
It relies heavily on physical proximity, established relationships, and frankly, the threat of violence.
Right, you know the person supplying you.
Or at least you know what they can do to you if you cheat them. But on the dark net, you strip all of that away entirely. You're dealing with a completely faceless pseudonym on the other side of the planet.
Right, just a screen name.
Exactly. So if you are a buyer, why on earth would you send thousands of dollars in Bitcoin to a total stranger, just hoping they mail you contraband?
Well, you wouldn't. It's a complete leap of faith.
Which is exactly why the platform itself had to step in and manufacture that trust artificially. Reputation scores and escrow systems became the substitute for real-world leverage.
I see. So it forces everyone to play nice.
Right. A buyer would send their Bitcoin to Silk Road. The platform would hold those funds in a centralized escrow wallet, and the money was only released to the vendor once the buyer confirmed the shipment actually arrived.
But implementing that system means someone somewhere is keeping a ledger.
Yes. That very architecture required the creation of centralized, permanent evidence. Usernames, private messages, detailed order histories, withdrawal records. Silk Road industrialized illicit commerce, sure, but by doing so, it forced a distributed network of pseudonymous users to interact with a centralized database.
A database that archived every single move they made.
Exactly. It was a gold mine of operational data, just waiting to be seized and compared to the public blockchain.
Which exposes the ultimate flaw of blind trust, I think. Because if you can't verify who is on the other side of the screen, things can get very dark and very weird very fast.
Oh, absolutely.
The source material outlines a specific incident that perfectly illustrates the psychological danger of this encrypted void. There was a Silk Road user going by the name Friendly Chemist.
Right, the Friendly Chemist situation.
Yeah, and Friendly Chemist decides to blackmail the platform, threatening to expose a massive list of vendor and customer information unless a debt is paid.
Which is a catastrophic threat. I mean, in an ecosystem where secrecy is literally the only currency that actually matters, a data leak of that magnitude would instantly destroy the entire marketplace.
So another vendor, someone allegedly known as Redan White, contacts Silk Road founder Ross Ulbricht. Redan White claims to control a significant drug trafficking operation in Western Canada and basically offers a permanent solution. They tell Ulbricht they can eliminate the Friendly Chemist threat by having him killed.
It's wild. A digital murder-for-hire proposal negotiated entirely through encrypted text.
And according to the indictment, Ulbricht goes for it. He transfers 1,670 Bitcoin, which was worth about $150,000 at the time, for this first purported hit.
Just unbelievable amounts of money.
And then Redan White sends back proof. A photograph of a man apparently lying in blood, accompanied by an agreed-upon secret string of numbers to prove it's authentic.
Yeah.
Investigators actually later found a thumbnail of this deleted, coded, bloody photo hidden on Ulbricht's laptop.
Just sitting there on the hard drive.
Yeah. And it didn't stop with one. Messages show Ulbricht paid hundreds of thousands of dollars more in Bitcoin for four additional targets.
Five purported murders orchestrated through a computer screen.
But then, law enforcement actually investigates the physical world, and they find absolutely zero evidence that any of these murders occurred.
Nothing.
No bodies, no missing persons reports matching the descriptions. It was a massive fraud, a pure impersonation scam.
A total fabrication.
And here's where it gets really interesting. How does a tech genius, literally the mastermind of the most sophisticated darknet market in history, fall for a fake photo and hand over hundreds of thousands of dollars in Bitcoin without having a clue who is actually on the other end of the transaction?
Well, that exposes the inherent structural vulnerability of anonymous markets. The exact same anonymity that is specifically intended to frustrate law enforcement also enables impersonation.
Right.
It enables fabricated threats, completely false proof. You can never truly verify your counterparty.
Because it's all just avatars.
Exactly. When your entire universe, your entire business exists strictly through encrypted text and avatars, a convincing narrative and a staged photograph become indistinguishable from reality.
Wow. So the system actually worked.
Yeah, the system worked exactly as designed. It kept identities perfectly hidden, which is precisely why the fraud was flawlessly successful.
The technology blinded him to the human reality. So, okay, Ulbricht allegedly gets scammed by this Redan White character. But that leaves a massive question. How does law enforcement figure out who Redan White actually is, like, a decade later?
Right. That's the real puzzle.
Our source material centers on a Canadian citizen named James Ellingson. Prosecutors allege that Ellingson wasn't just Redan White, but that he controlled a whole network of accounts on Silk Road.
Right. Multiple personas.
Yeah. Accounts like Marijuana's My Muse, which allegedly sold meth, heroin, cocaine, LSD, MDMA, and weed between 2011 and 2013. And another account, Lucy Drop, which allegedly sold narcotics and withdrew thousands of Bitcoin.
And moving from the crime itself to the digital breadcrumbs requires a massive leap in forensic accounting.
How so?
Well, the challenge for investigators isn't just seeing the transactions. The blockchain is a public ledger, right? So anyone can see that wallet A sent a specific amount of Bitcoin to wallet B.
Sure, it's public.
The true challenge is attribution. Connecting a string of meaningless letters and numbers to a physical human being sitting at a keyboard.
Let's talk about the mechanics of how they actually trace that, because it's not a straight line, is it?
Oh, not at all.
Criminals know the blockchain is public, so they don't just send money directly from their darknet account to their personal bank.
Right. They attempt to create a labyrinth. They use a technique often referred to as a peeling chain.
A peeling chain. Okay, how does that work?
So imagine a criminal has 100 Bitcoin from selling illicit goods. They don't move all 100 at once.
That would be too obvious.
Exactly. They send one Bitcoin to a new wallet and 99 Bitcoin to a change address.
Okay.
Then they take that 99, send one to another wallet, and 98 to a new change address. And they repeat this hundreds of thousands of times.
Bouncing funds all over the place.
Bouncing funds through intermediary addresses, mixing services, dummy wallets. Just trying to create so much noise that a human investigator simply loses the trail.
But humans aren't the ones doing the tracing anymore, are they?
No, not at all. Blockchain analysis software thrives on that exact kind of data. Algorithms can cluster these thousands of microtransactions, mathematically stripping away the noise, to follow the core volume of the funds.
That is incredible.
Yeah. Prosecutors claim that using this advanced analytics, they followed the proceeds from those specific Silk Road vendor accounts, Lucy Drop and Marijuana Is My Muse.
Right.
They mapped the peeling chains and intermediary addresses until the flow of Bitcoin finally consolidated and landed at accounts held at Bitstamp and a Canadian crypto exchange called Cavertex.
And this is where the digital ghost hits a brick wall. Because to open those exchange accounts, Ellingson allegedly used his real name.
He did.
He used identity documents. And according to the source, he used a utility bill.
A physical utility bill, yeah.
Let me just pause on this because it feels like a total disconnect. He used a utility bill, a piece of physical mail. People talk about Bitcoin as the ultimate untraceable ghost currency, but this makes it sound like a myth.
Well, it is a profound myth, honestly. It's born from a misunderstanding of how the technology actually works.
How so?
We have to clearly separate obfuscation from invisibility. Bitcoin is pseudonymous. You know, it's not anonymous.
Pseudonymous, meaning it has a fake name, but it's still an identity.
Exactly. You can rotate addresses and move assets rapidly all you want, but the blockchain mathematically preserves the transaction path forever. Total anonymity completely breaks down at the point of conversion.
The off-ramp.
Yes, the off-ramp.
When you try to turn your crypto into fiat money, like regular US or Canadian dollars, so you can actually buy groceries or pay rent or buy a car.
Exactly. When the blockchain interfaces with a centralized, regulated financial exchange, that exchange is legally required to collect Know Your Customer, or KYC, documentation.
The paperwork.
The paperwork. The old IP logs, driver's licenses, traditional bank routing details. In this case, prosecutors allege an email address incorporating Ellingson's real name was used to set up the accounts. And a search of that very same email address revealed a Silk Road vendor credential, plus detailed operational notes on drug weights, pricing, and sales figures.
It's the catastrophic alignment of two totally different data sets. You have the on-chain evidence, the public, unalterable math of the transactions.
Right.
Matching perfectly with the off-chain evidence. The emails, the utility bills, the exchange records.
Because blockchain analysts follow the mathematical flow of value, but investigators use traditional police work to attribute the control of that value to a person.
They mean in the middle.
Exactly. Then prosecutors connect both sets of evidence to satisfy the legal elements of a crime. It's the combination of on-chain and off-chain data that makes this case so incredibly durable.
But having this airtight digital evidence doesn't mean law enforcement can just knock on his door the next day, right?
No, unfortunately not.
Let's look at the legal reality of where this case stands right now, in 2026. First, we need to clarify a crucial distinction our source makes. James Ellingson is not charged with murder or murder for hire.
No, he isn't.
The whole hitman narrative is just alleged factual background to explain the context of those massive Bitcoin transfers.
Because the sensational narrative often overshadows the actual legal mechanics here.
Yeah.
You can't charge a homicide without evidence a homicide actually occurred.
Right. So the U.S. indictment, which was unsealed in May 2023, charges him with three counts. Conspiracy to distribute controlled substances, conspiracy to import them, and conspiracy to commit money laundering.
Right.
Let's clarify that last one. How does moving Bitcoin around equal money laundering?
Well, money laundering, at its core legal definition, involves conducting financial transactions with the proceeds of a crime in a way that conceals the original illicit source of that money.
Okay.
So if you sell heroin for Bitcoin, that Bitcoin is dirty.
Right.
The moment you push that Bitcoin through a complex web of intermediary wallets and eventually deposit it into a centralized exchange to convert it into clean Canadian dollars, you are actively attempting to disguise the nature and ownership of the funds.
Got it.
The transaction itself becomes a separate federal crime.
which carries massive penalties.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Ross Ulbricht, the Silk Road founder, was convicted back in 2015, served years in prison, but then received a full unconditional presidential pardon in January 2025.
He did, yes.
Yeah.
Though the source explicitly notes that the pardon has absolutely no bearing on Ellingson's situation.
Really?
Yeah. A pardon for the platform administrator does not determine the identity, guilt, or extradition status the individual vendors who allegedly utilized the platform.
Okay, that makes sense. And that brings us to the extradition timeline, which is, frankly, staggering.
It's incredibly slow.
Ellingson is a Canadian citizen in Canada. A British Columbia judge initially declined to commit him for extradition to the U.S. in 2025, citing insufficient evidence.
Right.
Then the B.C. Court of Appeal reversed that decision in April 2026. So in June 2026, Ellingson applied to the Supreme Court of Canada. And as of today, August 2026, it is still pending.
Still waiting.
Silk Road shuts down in 2013. The indictment drops in 2023. Ulbricht is pardoned in 2025. And right now in 2026, Ellingson is still fighting extradition. Why does this take over a decade?
Well, it really highlights the massive friction between the lightning fast speed of digital crime and the slow grinding reality of international law.
They move at totally different speeds.
Exactly. Identifying a suspect on a blockchain doesn't magically teleport them into a courtroom.
Sadly not.
The United States is alleging conduct that spans Canada, the U.S., and a borderless digital space. Because the suspect resides in Canada, authorities have to satisfy the Canadian extradition process.
Which means
navigating completely different evidentiary standards, constitutional rights, and appeals processes. Digital evidence crosses borders instantly, but human beings do not.
That is a great point. But financial institutions and law enforcement aren't just sitting around waiting for decade-old cases to resolve, are they?
Oh, definitely not.
They are actively learning from the architecture of Silk Road to hunt networked criminal activity today. Our source details what they call the 7-layer control stack. Because if a darknet market fragments visibility, you know, where one bank only sees a customer buying crypto with fiat money, another service only sees a self-hosted wallet kept on a personal thumb drive, and a third handles the cash out years later, how do you actually catch them? Standard background checks must be totally useless.
They are. A simple name screening completely fails because criminal usernames like LucyDrop don't match legal passports.
Right.
So the financial industry had to build a holistic, multi-stage filtration system to catch different variations of illicit behavior.
Let's walk through this filtration system because it's fascinating. The first filter seems obvious. Customer due diligence at the entry and exit points.
Layer one.
Rigorously verifying IDs when money enters or leaves the crypto ecosystem. But the second filter is where it gets highly technical, right? Blockchain analytics.
Yes, layer two. That is the software mapping the peeling chains we discussed earlier.
Oh, okay.
It is constantly scanning the ledger to identify illicit wallet clusters, tagging addresses associated with known darknet markets or, you know, ransomware gangs.
So even if the ID from layer one is clean, the math in layer two flags the wallet.
Exactly.
Then the third filter is behavioral monitoring. So if a seemingly normal account starts exhibiting rapid purchase and withdrawal cycles or exclusively transacts with brand new anonymous external addresses, the system flags the behavior regardless of the user's background.
Right. It looks for suspicious activity patterns. And then the fourth layer is wallet attribution governance.
What does that mean?
It's essentially the meticulous cataloging of intelligence. An institution must record exactly why they believe a specific string of numbers belongs to a bad actor.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, grading the reliability of that intelligence so it can actually hold up in court later.
Okay, then you have the fifth filter, the travel rule. And for anyone unfamiliar, it's essentially treating digital asset transfers like a wire transfer.
Right.
If you move crypto between institutions, the originator and beneficiary data has to travel with the money, acting like a digital passport.
Yes. And the sixth layer is perhaps the most critical for modern investigations, cross-channel investigation.
Why is that one so critical?
Because criminals don't live in silos. They use a traditional bank account to fund a crypto exchange, to move Bitcoin to a self-hosted wallet, to buy illicit goods.
They mix the traditional and the digital.
Exactly. Institutions can no longer analyze bank transfers, credit cards, and blockchain activities separately. They must merge the data to see the whole picture.
Wow. And the final layer, the seventh filter, is retrospective review. This is like the time machine aspect, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
When a new marketplace is busted today and thousands of new illicit wallets are suddenly identified, institutions don't just look forward. They run those wallets backward against their entire historical database to see if a seemingly legitimate customer interacted with those threat actors, like 5 years ago.
Exactly. All of which culminates in the ultimate goal, which is rapid asset restraint.
Freezing the money.
Right. The ability to legally freeze those digital assets before the suspect realizes the net is closing and vanishes.
So what does this all mean? Looking at this entire seven-layer stack, it feels like stopping modern financial crime is literally reversing the criminal's timeline.
That's a great way to put it.
The criminal tries to create distance. They start as an anonymous online persona, execute a transaction, launder it through various services, and finally try to obscure the human being holding the mouse.
Right.
The investigators run that exact tape backward. They take the online persona, mathematically trace the transaction, identify the off-ramp service provider, and unmask the person at the keyboard.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, it fundamentally changes how we view financial defense.
Oh, so?
Well, a clean background check means absolutely nothing if the behavioral patterns and the blockchain mathematics indicate a risk. Financial institutions today treat blockchain data as just one puzzle piece in a much wider intelligence picture.
Right.
A wallet risk score isn't a conviction on its own, but when you combine it with emails, exchange records, and cross-channel banking history, it builds an inescapable web.
It is truly an incredible journey. For you listening, think about the sheer scale of this evolution. We started with a darknet drug bazaar in 2013, an environment that aggressively promised total bulletproof invisibility.
Yeah, full anonymity.
Right. We walk through fake hitman plots, encrypted communications, and millions of dollars moving through the digital ether. And yet, that digital paper trail was so mathematically durable, so perfectly preserved on the blockchain and exchange servers, that it has fueled a high-stakes legal battle reaching the Supreme Court of Canada in August of 2026.
Amazing.
It proves that the digital footprints we leave behind are literally written in stone.
And, you know, that leaves us with a critical, lingering question to consider.
What's that?
If a darknet marketplace that was dismantled over a decade ago is still generating major legal cases today, specifically because the blockchain preserves the transaction path forever.
Right.
What does that actually mean for the illegal activities happening on the dark web right now?
Oh, wow.
Are the supposedly untraceable criminal masterminds operating today simply writing the unsealed indictments of 2039?
A digital time capsule that bites back. Just waiting to be dug up by the algorithms of the future. Thank you for joining us as we explored the absolute limits of digital anonymity. Take a second to think about your own digital footprint, because as we've learned today, the internet truly never forgets. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.